Welcome back to Public Address Radio on Radio Live. Politics is a promising business, meaning that politicians are fond of making promises to we the public. But how often, after the votes are counted and a government formed, are those promises kept? That's the focus of a five-year study undertaken and just published by Canterbury University's Nathan McCluskey as part of his PhD. I caught up with Nathan during the week to ask what he found out. Nathan, I suppose the obvious thing to start with is what was the motivation for this study? Why did you want to do it?
I suppose there are a number of reasons. First of all, I wanted to do a PhD, and I wanted to do it on a New Zealand politics subject area because I was particularly passionate about that. But I wasn't really clear what I wanted to do, and I was having a chat with my father about it, and I said to him, we've got any ideas? And he said, I think you should do it on why politicians are such blooming liars. And so that became the kind of, the essence behind the research. And so I started to do some research on that, and I began to see pretty early on that the statement or the question presupposed that they were, but there was actually no evidence to support that. I mean, there was lots of anecdotal evidence, but there was no real solid linear research to determine, you know, how much of what they said they did or didn't do. And so that's really what shaped what I ended up doing, which was to actually determine how many promises were kept.
Do you think that blimmin' liars view is one that's more widely held in people of your father's generation?
Than in younger people.
Than in younger people?
Very good question. Yeah, it definitely. You know, I was just talking to a couple of ladies at the cafe here at university, and they are not as old as my father, but certainly a generation above me, and they certainly were giving me the impression that that was what they felt, that things had deteriorated, and. Whether younger people feel the same way or not, I think it's shifted in younger people. So that I think the older generation feel that they can't be trusted. The younger generation feel like it doesn't matter, like I don't care. That's more of that's how it manifests rather than I don't think you can trust them.
Mm. Yeah. So what did you discover? You know, was there a gap between the public's perception of political promise keeping and the actual reality?
I think there's a huge gap, actually. If you look at surveys around trust in politicians, they've been decreasing over time, not just in New Zealand, but this is a phenomenon throughout Western democracies. And, of late, I think there was something put out not too long ago, it ranked politicians right down the bottom. And so we're talking about, you know, single-figure percentages of people who believe that politicians are trustworthy. We probably shouldn't get confused between the personal integrity of politicians and what political parties say, because they are slightly different things. And my research did focus on political parties themselves rather than the individual politicians. And I guess the kind of fracas around Winston Peters and so on was one of those things which tends to colour people's perception, but it doesn't actually relate to New Zealand First policy as such. So I suppose that's a distinction which needs to be drawn. But I guess there is a gap, and it's not unique to New Zealand. Research has been done overseas shows similar things. There was some very good research that's been done in Sweden in which they've had very high levels of policy implementation, and yet the public they've done surveys on this and found that the public perception is very low in terms of trust in political figures. And in New Zealand, you know, the survey research we've done in New Zealand shows the same thing, but it doesn't really reflect reality. So there's a huge gap, yeah.
Because the popular narrative here is certainly that the fourth Labor government in 1984 and then the National government that followed both duped the electorate and didn't do what they said they were going to do, which led to public support for MMP. Is that actually borne out by your research?
Yes, it is. And I think, you know, Richard Preble has responded to my research in the Herald by saying, it doesn't take account of the fact that there are all kinds of exigencies and circumstances which require governments not to follow their policies. And to some extent, he's actually right, and it might be irresponsible even to implement promises when you have a stock market crash or when you have an oil shock or whatever that could drive your country into serious economic, economic ruin even. If you look at maybe what happened in 74 or some of the issues that occurred around the change of government in 84, for example. That's one of the things that's open to debate, whether we, and that goes right back to, you know, Edmund Burke's, do we actually elect people to do what they said they would do, or do we elect them and just trust that they'll do the right thing? If you look at the fourth Labor government and the fourth National governments, the attitude changed from what we had before. If we look at Norm Kirk, and I was talking to Michael Bassett, and he said, I can remember vividly Norm Kirk thumping his meaty hand down on the Red Manifesto book on the cabinet table and saying, if it's not in here, we won't do it. And Winston Peters said a similar thing about Rob Muldoon, you know. But then we have this kind of shift to an elitist view of politics, which is we'll just do what's best for the country. And that's really the way that the kind of the Roger Douglas crew or I feel that, Ruth Richardson probably saw things that we had to do this because that was the necessity. When Mike Moore says when we came in 84, we had no idea that the public accounts were in such serious straits. And Bob Tizard says, you know, that basically as a result of the devaluation of the dollar and our exchange dropping so significantly, it meant in the run on the dollar, and you could look at Roger Douglas for why that happened. That's another story. But because of that, he said that really coloured what we could do for the next 6 years, because all of a sudden everything we bought from overseas doubled in price. Our overseas debt just increased that much more and was that much harder to pay off. And so all of a sudden everything became that much more difficult to do. And so that would be, I guess, used as an excuse. And then you fast forward to 1919, you've got Ruth Richardson, who would say, you know, David Cagle was saying we had a budget surplus, and in effect we actually had a $5.2 billion deficit, and we didn't know that till we came in. And that, you know, really was the backdrop to the mother of all budgets, effectively.
And then if you fast forward again to 1999, you had Labor bringing up the pledge card, which contained, what was it, half a dozen things they knew they could deliver. And that seemed to work for them quite well politically.
Yes. Well, I think Helen Clark's been interesting because she sought, because in the 1990s, what National did really is they shifted from, if you look at Labor's manifesto in 87, for example, it contained over 1,000, or in fact over 1,100 pledges or direct promises. And then if you go to the next election, 1990, National's manifesto contained just over 200. So there was a huge shift from the big manifesto to a much smaller one. And what happened is there was this under-promising. So we just didn't talk about a lot of things. So, for example, in 1990, National said nothing about electricity. But, of course, that was a huge issue through the 90s. So it seemed that they decided that we'd better just not to talk about stuff, and then we've got a blank page to do things. And I think that is a warning to the electorate, actually, to be very careful when you see a political party not talking about a particular issue or not being prepared to commit, and I would say on hard copy and on paper, to a particular issue that can be, you know, held as a monitoring device. Then you should be very careful about what that party might do with a particular policy issue. So, I do think that on the back of that, Helen Clark then looked and said, I need to restore some integrity to politics, and one way I'll do this is by making promises important once again, but I'll focus on, you know, some core policies which are going to enable me to appeal to the electorate, and I can do, they're doable, and so I'll restore some of this integrity which seems to have been lost.
Just briefly, you mentioned there is other international research like this. How do New Zealand political parties rate compared to those in the rest of the world in terms of keeping those promises?
Pretty good, actually. If you look at New Zealand overall, over the study period, we sit at 73%, and that is lower than Sweden on 87 and UK on 84, but that ranks us third out of all the countries that have been studied, and about 11 countries have been studied. And in terms of under first past the post, it was 75%, that's still third. Under MMP, it drops down to 62, but that was really negatively influenced by that first MMP government with National New Zealand First. So more recently, last term, Labor's actually gotten as high as 82% pledge fulfillment. So I think overall, internationally, we stack up pretty good. I mean, a lot of countries that we might look at and say they've got good economies and so on actually have reasonably low levels of fulfillment. I mean, I'm looking at, if you want to look at, say, from 60% down, US, France, Netherlands and Ireland only has about 50% fulfillment overall. And in fact, for one, at least one term of government in Ireland, the opposition fulfilled more pledges than the party in government. So that was a strange turn of events, I guess.
Well, I'm sure we'll all be talking about this for a while. And congratulations for actually getting that one thing that we all need lots of, some sweet, sweet data on the stuff that we actually argue about.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Nathan McCluskey there. After the break, the complete idiot's guide to being a model.